meets to order and open the public hearing for HB 5034, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Steve, do you have anything you want to before we start?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, no, I don't have any additional information at this time. The agency is just ready to continue with its presentation. I think we stopped on, I think it was at the bottom of page 7, top of page 8 in your slide handout yesterday, and they're going to kind of skip over the next 5 slides and get into how the agency uses its budget and then to revisit the earlier slide a little later on.
That's fine, thank you.
Nan
Evans.
Chair Mesley, members of the committee, for the record, Nan Evans, the interim director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I first do want to take an opportunity to give you some material and follow up to some of yesterday's questions. The first handout describes the public participation in LCDC's strategic plan, and it lists the stakeholder groups, it lists the members of those groups, it lists the dates the public hearings were held, it also lists the local officials advisory committee that was involved, and we expanded that group to include a slightly larger group of folks. It also lists the members of the Citizen Involvement Advisory Committee and when they met, the meetings we had with our state and federal partners. It also includes some material that was posted on the agency's website, as well as a survey that was posted on the website asking people about their perceptions of the agency and their priorities of issues to deal with. That survey is printed here in this handout. And then there is also a sort of a summary by question of how respondents to the survey ranked the various issues. Because an overall sort of summary is sometimes leads to more questions than not, we've also given a summary of where the local officials who responded to the survey ranked various issues, and then where staff ranked various issues. So you can see actually where the differences of opinions are. And then at the last couple pages of that handout are a couple of articles. One occurred in the Capital Press. Another was an example of an article that was in the OBIA publication. And with that, we'd answer further questions if you like on the public involvement process.
Nan, there were no public hearings after the committees got through with their work, though?
Chair Mazzoli, there were public hearings before LCDC. This was an effort that was essentially begun by the commission, and the commission was the sort of guiding body as it went through the process. So the public hearings were in front of the commission. They were held in December of 2001 and January of 2002. Also, as we indicated yesterday, we actually began the process in the fall of 2001, and the commission adopted the planning elements in the summer of 2002. During that period, we had a couple of director changes. And we also did, in fact, try to do it on a very prudent, limited budget and use the Internet a lot. I think we got 225 responses, I believe, to our Internet survey. So I think it was a fairly effective tool.
There was one public hearing by the commission held in Salem, I assume?
I believe both the hearing in December and January were in Salem.
Thank you. Any other questions, committee? Thank you.
Then the second handout is a result of a conversation we had yesterday that I gave you slightly misleading information. It lists the 19 land use planning goals and the dates they were adopted. The first cluster were adopted in December of 1974. There was a Willamette River Greenway goal adopted in December of 75, and then the remaining coastal goals December of 76.
Okay. Any questions? Comments?
Thank you.
The next handout addresses some of the questions that the committee had regarding activities that the department has really fairly recently begun to focus on economic development efforts, both in the short and the long term. And this memo identifies some of the specific recent efforts we've taken. It talks about a temporary rule that I addressed yesterday, and I think to point out one further piece of information about this temporary rule, the commission did adopt it just this March. It was an attempt to reduce the requirements for industrial development in unincorporated rural communities, and it basically did two things. One was to increase the square footage of allowed industrial-sized buildings from 10,000 square feet to 40,000, and it provides for the redevelopment of mill sites. We also talked a little bit yesterday about fast-tracking of some large industrial sites in the Portland metropolitan area that the commission approved in March. There are other things that we are doing, and that right now, because this is kind of admittedly sort of a new focus for the department, we are looking at ways to increase the capacity in the department, finding of an aggregate specialist. We also have a package that we'll talk about a little later that does not have a general fund increase to it, but would provide some increased capacity in the department for an economic development specialist. Some of the other bullets in that handout talk about some of the efforts we're working with the legislature to, both in the short and long term, address some of the economic development issues that land use can perhaps be in a role of stimulating. I've included in this package a brief summary of the temporary rule and the rule itself, which is, and I've included the press release on the fast tracking.
And your bullet point one, action by the commission, and the bullet point on House Bill 2691. What is it? Is 2691 the bill that came out of Florence, Lane County, basically? And what is the need for that bill if you've already increased the square footage allowed?
I believe you are correct, and that's a discussion that the substantive committees are having as whether there are additional changes necessary or that need to be done by statute, or whether to do the temporary rule direction.
So they are dealing with the same issue.
Yeah. And the temporary rule, it's temporary because it was a way we could do it fast and addressed an issue immediately. It does require us then to go back and do full rulemaking, I think within 180 days.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to yesterday.
Yes,
I must have caught you off guard there, so apologize for that.
That's all right. I realized that I just wasn't on top of my response to you. I apologize for that.
Any questions from the committee on this handout?
Okay. The fourth handout is in response to a question from Representative Krieger about conversion of farm and forest lands. And this is a farm and forest report that we produced biannually for the commission and the legislature. And we can go into some details on that. I sort of don't know where to start and would probably want to bring in our farm and forest specialist if you ask me a very specific question. But we might want to come back to this at some point in the future. But it is to give you some information that we do track these things fairly closely. We do find that the vast majority of farm and forest dwellings are on large parcels, that they're on allowed zones. I guess I would answer any questions, or I would bring in our farm and forest specialist probably to answer the questions on that one.
Questions? Committee? And we've had an awful lot of farmland that's been purchased and taken out of production. Some of it permanently out of production. Is that tracked when you deal with farmland, or do you just track what's gone into housing?
Senator Masley, I think that's something I'll have to get back on you, because I don't know the answer to that. And we will bring that an answer back tomorrow.
Okay. Appreciate that.
Let's see. There are two other handouts for today.
Would you mind giving them both to Sue?
She's okay.
We're wearing Sue out here.
The first handout is in response to a question by Chair Meserly about the numbers of appeals that DLCD and LCDC have initiated. These would be appeals of local land use decisions to LUBA. Within the last biennium, there are seven listed, with hopefully a thumbnail sketch of the issue, the outcome, and the Attorney General's expense for each of those appeals.
Any questions at this time? We'll be delving into, we can ask questions about this when we get into the budget. Thank you.
And the last handout is just a fairly brief memo in response to Senator Dukes' questions about sort of where were the natural resources in our strategic initiatives and some of the efforts there. And it is a very brief response. If there's more detail, we'd be glad to provide it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Representative Johnson.
The only other piece from yesterday in response to Senator Duke's question that I also have a particular interest in is the fundraising activities with respect to the Tillamook Interpretive Center.
That's a different agency, though.
Oh. I'm sorry.
Chair Meserly, Representative Johnson, I would be pleased to tell you that we have none.
I'm sorry.
Oh, good. You have an answer.
Great.
Text me if you're listening.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
Representative Johnson, you're turning red.
I should. That's about the dumb question of the century.
It's all right. We all have our moments. So. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, well, where I'd like to start today, with your permission, is to talk a bit in general about what the agency does, how we're organized to do that, the tools we use, the services we provide, and some of the special programs, and show you a little bit about how our budget is organized. And then from there we can do the details. This is a simple version of how we're organized. You can find the complex version behind Part 1, Tab 2, 7 is where that starts. We are, as a department, operate under the policy direction of the Land Conservation and Development Commission, a group of seven volunteer citizens, of which the chair... Chair Randy Frankie is in the audience today. These are seven individuals who represent both a diverse geography as well as sort of areas of expertise. There are county commissioners, mayors, real estate developers, farmer. And this is the group that provides the policy direction. the two advisory committees to the commission, the local officials advisory committee, the members of those were listed in that first handout I gave to you on the strategic planning, and the citizens involvement advisory committee, and those members were also listed in that first handout. The director's office and four divisions. We've been recently have undergone a reorganization process with an effort to provide essentially an organizational way to deliver services better. The local and regional unit there, which I think I told you yesterday, they've just renamed themselves to Community Services Division. That's one less or two less words, maybe. Provide really the key folks that work with the local jurisdictions. These are the field reps that provide a lot of service sort of on the ground. There are two field reps who cover the coast. There's a field rep that covers southern Oregon, two field reps that cover the east, and the remainder are located in sort of the Willamette Valley metropolitan area. I think currently we're down to, I believe, six in the 2003-05 budget. We will be down to four field staff in the Valley metropolitan area. The manager for that division is Rob Halliburton, who is sitting behind me and you'll hear from shortly. The planning division contains essentially the policy specialists. These are the people that know about things like urban development. These are the people who know and manage the transportation growth management program and work with transportation development issues. This is also where we have the federally funded program, which is a floodplain management program. So these are the specialists. They serve as sort of information sources for the field reps, and they also work directly with local jurisdictions when there's a particular issue involved that requires sort of a special expertise. And the manager of that unit is Ann Beyer, who's sitting behind me. The third division is the Coastal Division. This is the federally funded division that works with jurisdictions in our coastal zone. It is entirely supported by federal funds and contains a lot of very specialized activities in there, including dealing with coastal hazards, something called federal consistency that we'll talk about later. And there's also a fairly significant, essentially for our agency, significant means we have one person, GIS function here, where we do have are developing a fairly sophisticated coastal atlas.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Nan, to what degree are you in contact with the Department of Revenue about any of the mapping and the GIS work that they're doing?
Chair Mazzoli and Representative Johnson, we are members of the DAS has a GIS group, and we do work with all the agencies, including revenue. And we've actually been able to take layers from other agencies, such as revenue producers, and put into this coastal atlas that has been accessible over the Internet to local planners and members of the public.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'm very pleased to hear that. We were hearing revenues budget in another committee, and fortunately I didn't get that confused with anything yet. But they were talking about really some of the astonishing things that they're able to do through the help of the assessors, feeding information into them, and that they can actually take large pieces of land and overlay wetlands and overlay all kinds of information. It seems to me that with the clarion call for streamlining that has come from both the governor's office and both caucuses, both sides of this building, that having somebody, some agency, own that process, and maybe it's the interjurisdictional committee that you're talking about, but we shouldn't be replicating those expensive systems in lots of different forums. And if one set of folks in an agency can help guide that map delivery and share it with the counties. What a benefit that would be to get real-time information about sophisticated topography and sophisticated elements of tracts of land. That would be wonderful. I'm thrilled to hear you're participating. There was no question in there.
Lastly, in terms of the organizational structure, is the operations division. This is the division that has sort of the core bits of things that allow an agency to function. It includes human resources. We have one human resource person. It includes our fiscal analyst and budget person, which is Teddy Leland, who sits over here. It also includes the accounting and payroll functions, which there are two people that do that. And the head of this division is Lainey Smith, who you met yesterday. And Lainey also adds to that division essentially the tracking of the performance measures and the strategic planning, because we're trying to meld the performance measurement function into a key part of our agency. So that's where the responsibility for overseeing that activity lies.
If I could, Nan, break in here before we move on to the next slide. I noticed in the local organization, the LOAC and the Citizens Advisory Committee, there in either group there is no representation from the coast.
I
just want to point out that there's four members of this committee on the Coastal Caucus. So maybe we're well covered on that.
Let me find the right handout.
And I can understand how those committees cover the whole state, but to not have any representation on either body seems a little...
So it says I found the right handout. The members of LOAC do include, and this is, they don't include a coastal jurisdiction. And when we expanded the LOAC involvement in the strategic plan, we involved what were sort of ex officio members and people who had been on the committee in the past, and particularly the Coos Bay City Manager, Bill Grile, was involved in that.
As in what capacity?
As a member of the expanded LOAC in involving in the strategic planning efforts. He has been a past member, I believe, of LOAC.
Could you list those for us in a supplement? Who you expanded that to? He wasn't on the list you handed out, was he?
He's...
I think she said ex officio.
Is Attachment B.
Okay.
Local Officials Advisory Committee. The members, the standing members currently are the top 2, 4, 6, 7, which you are correct, does not include a coastal member.
Okay.
The ex officio list is the folks we expanded it to for the strategic plan purposes, and that's where we brought in the participation of Bill Grile.
There was maybe it's not on the rest of them. There's a line through the ex officio members, so I assume they were.
I don't know what that means.
Thank you.
One more comment, perhaps, before we move from the sort of organizational structure, just to give you an idea about how big we are. Currently, we have about 60 FTE in the governor's budget for 03-05, and the governor's balance budget will be revised here at the table. But when we get through that revision, we'll be looking at about 47.6 FTE. So that's just to give you.
You're talking about the governor's revision?
Yeah.
It's coming up this week?
I'm sorry. Chair Mezzoli, we are adjusting the governor's balanced budget. We will bring some adjustments to the table to you with the support of BAM and LFO that adjust some of the numbers in the governor's balanced budget. The governor's budget he'll be releasing on Friday. I'm not privy to.
Senator Dukes.
So, as of today, you have how many?
As of today, we have position authority for 60 FTE in the 62 positions, and that includes some limited duration positions.
Okay, and you're saying that when you're finished with the juggling, you'll have...
Well, when we're finished with... When we present to you an adjustment to the governor's balance budget, we'll have 51 positions and 47.6 FTE.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead. Thank you.
What I'd like to do next is then go from the sort of notion of organization to the tools or services that staff and the organization provide. And to spend just a moment first on a definitional issue, we think about our service provision in terms of the communities we serve. The word urban, when used in a land use planning sense, I want to make sure we're all sort of using it with the same definition. It means areas within the urban growth boundaries of all of Oregon's 240 incorporated cities. So when we use urban, we're not talking about metropolitan Portland. That's just one set of those. We're including all of the incorporated cities. When we use the word coastal, and there is some overlap here, there are some urban areas certainly within the coast. When we use the word coastal, we talk about that area between the Columbia River and the California border, and from the crest of the coast range out 3 miles. And that includes about 7 counties and 30-some local jurisdictions. When we use the word rural, we're talking about those unincorporated county lands that are outside of urban growth boundaries. It's the field reps that deliver primarily the services to these communities, and when we responded to the request to prioritize our programs, when we look at that eventually, you will see that we prioritize them based on the communities we serve. And within each set of communities or community types, we have a set of tools or services that we can provide depending on what the need is. So with that...
Questions? Go ahead.
Our toolbox. And to start the discussion of the toolbox, I'm going to ask Rob Halliburton to join me. Let me make a budget note here. We have 3 budget units. Our operations budget unit includes almost everything we do. It's all staff except one, and it's the bulk of everything. So when eventually we get to talking budget, when we talk operations unit, that's almost everything. There are only 2 other units. There's a grants unit that contains the expenditure limitation for all the special payments to cities and counties in the local grants programs. There's no staff in that budget unit, and there's no services and supplies or anything else. It's just the grants. The third budget unit is the landowner owner notification budget unit that is it's got half an FTE in it, and it's the budget unit that responds to a ballot measure that requires notification of land use actions. So most everything we do is in this operations budget unit. And now Rob is going to talk to you about what we do there.
Chairman Ezra, members of the committee, I'm Rob Halliburton, the Community Services Division Manager, or Regional and Local Services Division Manager, depending on which list you're looking at. Thank you for listening to me today. I wanted to talk about a few of the tools that we use specifically those that that my division, the regional representatives, use in assisting local governments in the land use planning program. The first I want to talk about is grants, and I'm only going to be talking about the grants that are in the general fund. We have other grants that come from other sources that other folks will be talking about today. And these are the periodic review grants and technical assistance grants. Actually, within our budget, I believe that that this just comes as a grant line item, and the division between periodic review and technical assistance is something we do within the department and isn't reflected in the budget itself. And I also wanted to mention that there's a list of the grants that we gave in this biennium in Appendix B of your book. And behind tab B on page 53 is the budget, the overall budget. This year, the general fund grants total approximately $2.5 million, which is a little down from the previous biennium of $2.7 million, and a little bit more than the governor's balanced budget, well, actually about 25% more than the governor's balanced budget of $2 million for the coming biennium. Regarding the periodic review grants, these, as the name implies, are provided to local governments for the express purpose of completing periodic review tasks. I gave you some examples on the slide here of the types of tasks that jurisdictions might use these grants for. These are fairly typical. An economic opportunities analysis is a part of every city's comprehensive land use plan, and it's an element of the plan that many other decisions are made from and need to be updated periodically, and frequently are updated through periodic review, funded with a periodic review grant. Urban growth boundary review is a fairly complex, involved process, can be, and we provide assistance to most cities that are in periodic review for that review. Public facilities plans are another area that many cities have found that part of their plan has gotten out of date over the years since their last periodic review or acknowledgement, and quite a few of our periodic review grants have gone to public facilities planning. And those are all urban-oriented, and as far as the rural area, a typical periodic review grant might go to a county to plan for their unincorporated communities. In the coming biennium, we do anticipate prioritizing our periodic review grants based on the budget goals displayed on the easel over here to your left, and integrating also with CST agencies and attempting to gain some leverage, I guess you could say, trying to target our resources better to those communities who need it the most, and pool state resources where we can.
I want to ask some questions on this slide. How often do you require periodic reviews?
As of right now, it depends on the size of the jurisdiction. For large cities and counties, it's every 5 to 10 years. For small cities and counties, it's every 5 to 15 years, except cities under 2,500 and counties under 15,000 population are exempt from having to do periodic review.
I would assume that some of your jurisdictions want to do it more often than that, simply because they've got a project or something that they want to get approved and moving on.
Do you have that happen very often?
I would say that rarely less than 5 years, but frequently less than the 15. Yes, we do have cities that request to come in well before the 15-year interval.
And second, when you provide grants for the periodic review, what percentage of the cost of these analyses does that grant cover?
Chairmaster Lee, that varies by jurisdiction. The amount of local match, that there is no requirement for local match, and especially for smaller jurisdictions with little resources, frequently our grant would cover 100%. For larger jurisdictions with larger, more complex projects, the local jurisdictions will contribute sometimes as much as 50%. That's real high. It's generally less, more like 10%.
Okay. Any other questions? Ready? Okay, go ahead.
Okay, that's all I had on periodic review grants. Another category is technical assistance grants, and these are for jurisdictions that have planning projects that, but they're not in periodic review, or those smaller jurisdictions that I mentioned that are exempt from periodic review. Some of them stayed in periodic review and at their own election, and if they need a grant to complete a task on their work program, that would be a technical assistance grant. Then another...
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Halliburton, you and I have talked about this before in terms of those technical assistance grants and the department incentivizing certain tasks to come in a particular order in periodic review. You may recall that there was quite a tempest raised in Columbia County when DLCD incentivized Columbia County to move their Goal 5 stuff way up on the list. Tell me a little bit about the philosophy in your department that would cause a task to be incentivized by a grant.
Chairman Esserly, Representative Johnson, I'm going to have to admit that I don't remember that firestorm in Columbia County. It must have been before I worked for the department. Their work program actually was developed before I worked for the department. But we generally look at the capacity of the local jurisdiction and what the greatest needs are in terms of where their plan might not be working as well. And so trying to weigh those two things, sometimes there would be a need identified where the resources simply aren't available to deal with it at the time, so something else might be raised higher on the priority. There was certainly at one point a statewide effort to get local plans caught up with the Goal 5 rule that was amended in 1996, and that might very well have been what came into play in Columbia County. When there are changes in regulations, well, of course, that's what a lot of periodic review tasks deal with, is changes in the regulations and getting those plans up to date. But is this answering your question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I think that those are the main things, is the needs of the local jurisdiction and capacity.
Thank you.
I forgot to ask one other question on the periodic review. How long does it generally take from when they start the process until they get approval, and how long does it take once DLCD receives the application until
there's
approval.
Chair Mazur, you are. I was going to go. My previous slide was on grants, and I was going to talk about periodic review more generally.
Sure, that's
thank important. You. Okay. Regarding technical assistance grants, again, many of these grants would be for tasks that are similar to the periodic review grants, only for jurisdictions that aren't in periodic review. But other tasks that we've funded this biennium include zoning ordinance updates that didn't include a plan amendment, planning commission training sessions. There have been several over the years for that. And also coordination amongst jurisdictions when it's, for example, population projection coordination, where it's not just one jurisdiction benefiting and wouldn't be one periodic review work program. That would be a technical assistance grant. And then additionally, one that there isn't a slide for, there's a subcategory of the technical assistance grants, which is the small city county grants. That's just our internal name for them. These are our small $1,000 grants with no strings attached, no product requirements. They used to be called maintenance grants that go to the smaller cities under 2,500 and the counties under 15,000, just for their operations and not for a particular project. Another tool that we use at DLCD, moving away from the grants, is technical assistance. Not technical assistance grants, but just technical assistance. We talk about this in behind tab A of your book, starting on page 6. This is particularly the field reps, but not just the field reps. The field representatives are sort of the face of the commission most of the time, but then the specialists, of course, come in as needed. But DLCD supplies expertise to local governments, to the citizens of the state, and state agencies and tribes. This was, in fact, what I did for the department for 3.5 years until a couple of weeks ago when I got my management job. And that expertise is basically what the laws are, and administrative rules, interpretations of those. A lot of the times there will be court or LCDC interpretations of regulations and that apply to an individual jurisdiction at the time but have broader implications, and we're sort of the central clearinghouse for letting the broader state know what those are. And we provide a lot of information to local jurisdictions on the procedures, notice procedures, and hearings procedures that are required by statute and other requirements. And then we also provide advice to planning issues. The distinction between the advice on this slide and the expertise is I think of the expertise as just being the dry facts. What does the law say? What did LUBA say? Whereas the advice is actually the application of those laws and helping the jurisdictions not only improve their plans but improve the implementation of their plans. For example, not long ago I got a call from a county that had a property owner that had a commercial operation in a rural area and a house all on a couple of acres. And the property owner was fine with his zoning. He'd had it going along for several years, no problem. But he wanted to refinance the business, and the bank wouldn't finance it with the house on the property. And it was a small, it was like an acre and a half property, and which was smaller than the minimum lot size in their commercial zones or their residential zones, and it was a problem. And so as a field rep, I got together with the county and the property owner and did problem solving and tried to help them through what turned out to be not as complicated as we thought it was, but that's just an example of the types of things that the field reps do to help the local jurisdictions. And also under technical assistance, we provide handbooks and model codes. This is largely through the TGM program. We've done some of it more generally. For example, we published an aggregate planning guide that was the primary audience was local jurisdictions. And in the economic development, an industrial siting handbook that we've recently completed with EDD. So we don't do a lot of that outside of the TGM program, but as we can, we do.
If you have a situation that develops at the local level, county or city, that where you go to give advice and it's not controversial, there's no controversy with the neighbors or anything, how much leeway does the department have to resolve some of those issues?
Well, it depends on the process, I think. If it's a local permit or a local plan amendment outside periodic review where we don't have approval authority, I would say a fair amount. And whether we choose to participate at all, of course, is the first decision we need to make. And then if we do choose to participate, do we participate in an advisory capacity only, or do we choose to take it further if we need? And that decision is internal. I would say the primary factor in determining whether or how much we want to be involved is first the impact on the ground, whether we believe that a development or a zone change, a plan change would be out of compliance with the goals. But even then, it's also whether there's a precedential effect that would have broader implications across the state that might tend to weaken the effectiveness of that goal. But in the technical assistance and plan amendments that I'll get to in a second, we participate in a very small proportion of those that go on around the state.
I guess it wasn't asking so much on participation, but how much authority you have. Because I think what most people want when they get in those difficult areas that simply don't fit the legal language, some kind of cover so that, you know, they don't get crossways down the road. I guess one way of asking it is, does the director have authority to sign off on certain things, you know, if it's very, very low impact, if any impact at all, and can they make a judgment on that and keep the process moving rapidly?
Chair Messerly, on most local land use decisions, we have no authority at all. outside periodic review. We have none. The only ability we have to affect those decisions is through advice and testimony, and then if it comes to that, through an appeal to the Land Use Board of Appeals. And those appeals are required to be approved by our commission, which obviously we go through our director before it goes to the commission on that. There's an internal decision first, and then it would go to the commission.
I mean, appreciate your being straightforward with this, but in tax situations such as our IRS, if there's some doubt in your mind whether this is legal or not, or you're going to get challenged or audited, you can sometimes get a letter of, I forget what they call it, there's a name for it, or you can present the case to the IRS and they will send you a letter back as to their opinion on it. Is there any process like that to give the local governments any cover at all?
Chair Messerly, we routinely do that sort of activity, but that letter that we send has no force of law in any way. It's not something that LUBA would take judicial notice of necessarily.
Okay. Senator Dukes?
Do you ever appeal a local land use decision yourselves?
Chair Messerly, Senator Dukes, yes, we do. Before you came in, we distributed a list of those that occurred this biennium. There were seven.
So I guess it's one thing to say you don't have any authority over them, and it's another to know that, for them at the local level, to know that send in comments, representatives deliver comments, you have the right to appeal. So say, while you may not be able to make the decision for them, have a significant amount of influence to exert over it.
Chair Messerly, if I might for a minute, I hear you asking the question about how much flexibility the department has in interpreting rules, and then if we indicate to a jurisdiction that there is flexibility, whether we'll stand with them on that. I think that is one of the issues certainly that the department has been criticized about in the past, and I'm hopeful that perhaps we can be more useful in the future. My knowledge of specific cases is fairly limited, but I do know of a recent instance where Metro, in working through some of its UGB expansions, there were several ways to interpret the guidelines and the rules and the hierarchies, and the department, using the services of the AG, worked with Metro to see which way might apply, and then Metro is bringing that issue in front of the commission soon, so I can't go very far into this one because I don't really know what will happen, but essentially what we're saying is that on the advice of staff and our attorneys, we thought this was a legitimate way to apply that methodology. And I think I probably better stop before I get myself into more trouble than I know on that particular case, because I didn't know much more than that.
Senator Dukes, are you? Well, then, you're clarifying my question for me. I appreciate that. If a local jurisdiction is concerned that they might be appealed by the department, can they ask for a letter of clarification? And would you indicate whether the department would appeal under those conditions or not?
Chair Messerly, I believe if they asked, we would probably give them an opinion. There has been some controversy in the past about how we express an intent to appeal and how we do it in a way that is not seen as threatening, but is seen as informational. And that is something I think we probably need to improve.
And I was thinking more in terms of, if you follow this procedure, we will not appeal, or if you...
We haven't done anything with that?
I'd rather see it with a positive spin.
Yeah, so would I.
Chair Messerly, you're putting it in a scenario that I don't have any experience with. I haven't been asked by a local jurisdiction to answer that question in that way. And I don't mean to suggest we don't have influence on local land use decision making. Direct authority was really what I only meant to say we didn't have. And as Nan said, it is a fine line that we have to play, have to be on, because we don't want to appear as threatening. We do prefer to assist local jurisdictions in their decision making, but it is also our responsibility to enforce the statewide land use planning goals. And in our technical assistance role, we do attempt to let the jurisdictions know when we think they're going to cross the line, or if we see something that we think has crossed the line, we do try to tell them how to fix it. But we don't generally couch it in terms of, if you do this, we will appeal, if you do that, we won't. Oftentimes those decisions aren't made at the field representative level. So it's a complex decision.
Not sure we've totally pulled this one out. So if you don't do it at the field level, is there a process at the director's level or even at the commission level where you can clarify that before everyone gets involved in the formal appeal?
Chair Mesley, now I'm not sure what the question is.
Let me try again. At the field level, someone jurisdiction has a concern that, you know, we're not sure if this is going to get us into an appeal or not. Can the field officer pass that up to either your office or even to the commission and get some kind of an opinion before they take action and then they're into the formal appeal process?
Chair Mesley, I think I know a generic answer to that, which is, I think working at the field rep level, the field reps can probably advise a local jurisdiction about, as Rob says, kind of where the clear line is, and then in that gray zone can talk about it and can then take it to their manager or the director if there's some interpretation needed there. The decision to actually appeal is a decision that is taken up through the director to the commission. And that would be where the commission would get involved, is in that final decision to appeal. And as the record shows, we've done 7 of those, I believe, in the last biennium. But what I'm hearing you say, and I guess perhaps if I'll turn it around a bit and say, perhaps I'm hearing you say that you would like us to work more with local jurisdictions in saying, within this sort of gray area where we can find flexible solutions, that if a jurisdiction chooses a path that isn't over the line, that we'll support them. And I'll take that as a suggestion.
We're getting closer to it, yes.
Yeah, okay.
What I'm interested in is keeping this process moving.
Mm-hmm.
We hear constantly, I'm sure all of us do at this table, of, you know, the process is just too complex, too burdensome. A lot of the projects that I see in my district, people finally give up, walk away. Not just land use, but when you put it all together, investors are not willing to take the chance because there is no guarantee that they're going to get through the process anyway. And they can go to other locations and have that guarantee. So I'm looking at a bigger picture, but I'm trying to bring it down to your department and see if there's room there to work. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. Move on.
Thank you. I believe I covered all I meant to on technical assistance. Moving on to another tool that we use is periodic review, which we've already talked about some. There is a short description of it starting on page 7 of your book on behind tab A. The periodic review process is designed to be a collaborative process for keeping the local comprehensive plans current. I say it's designed to be. Periodic review is one tool that we have that honestly hasn't worked quite as well as we'd hoped, as well as it was designed when it was first put in statute some dozen years ago. And we're working on it. There was a piece of reform legislation, Senate Bill 543, in the 99 legislative session, and there is a bill being worked on this session to further reform the periodic review process, to streamline it and make it work better for both the local jurisdictions and the state. But it's also a different process than a plan amendment process that's a totally local process. It does provide opportunities for consultation with other state agencies and for citizen involvement. In 543, Senate Bill 543, two sessions ago, among the reforms were, as I previously mentioned, the exemption of small cities and counties from the requirement to perform periodic review. But it also focused periodic review on four topics or goals, depending on how you look at it: economic development, public facilities, transportation, and housing. And so the focus of periodic review work programs, the tasks on those programs, and the grants to those tasks after 1999 became more focused on those areas, at least for those work programs that came into effect after that time. There are still work programs that predate 543, some by quite a bit. I believe Senator Messerly asked previously how long it takes for a jurisdiction to complete periodic review, and the answer is it varies considerably. Counties particularly, so far the history has been it takes a real long time. There are some counties that started in the late 80s that still haven't finished. Not to say they haven't done anything. They have, most all have completed considerable plan updates. They just haven't finished all of the tasks on their work program. And of course, with cities, it varies considerably. For smaller cities, especially those that haven't grown a lot, a city can get through periodic review in a year or two. There's one, at least, that their work program was approved after Senate Bill 543 in 1999, LeGrand, and they're just about done. And Bandon is another one that got their work program after Senate Bill 543, and they've made considerable progress. I don't know exactly how close they are to being done, but I know that they're getting there. So it depends on a lot of things. When they started, the earlier they started, it seems the longer it takes. But the ones that have started more recently seem to be getting through it faster. So the point I'm hoping to get across here is hopefully the reforms we made in Senate Bill 543 will start to take hold, and the average time in periodic review will start to go down.
What are the reasons for it taking so long for some counties?
It's a lot of issues, Chair Messerly. I believe that part of it is the resources available from both the state and the local level to put to periodic review is part of it. Part of it is things happen. Things like Ballot Measure 7 happen. The Endangered Species Act happens, slowed down a lot of jurisdictions' efforts on wetland and riparian area protection. And then things we do, like Old Five Rule happens. And sometimes what was envisioned at the time the work program was written and agreed upon, sometimes over time it evolves and finds out it's more work than had originally been anticipated. And to that end, we have gone in already and started to clean up a lot of those work programs of tasks that have gotten out of hand. And even though there's a lot of jurisdictions still in periodic review, a lot of them are, more and more of them are getting very close to being done.
And if we could have some kind of a report on across the board who is behind and
what the expected, how we're working through that, and when we'll expect to get them through that process. Yeah. Senator Dukes?
Do you think the majority of the problems have been worked out? I mean, spending way more time on periodic review than you did on the original plan doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. And so you've indicated we did a bill last session, we're looking at another one this session. Are we getting to those things, particularly with the counties, it sounds like? I mean, 15 years of periodic review seems a little steep.
Chairman Ezerly, Senator Dukes, it's a little soon for me to be very confident, but I do believe we are making progress, and that with the further reforms that are being discussed for this legislative session, I believe that significant progress will be made. But it's a little early for me to say that with certainty. But also, as I mentioned, there are a lot of counties and cities that are getting close, that have like one, maybe two tasks left on their work program. But then we're also running into difficulties with budgets now, and even getting those last work tasks completed may prove to be a challenge. And that's one of the things that we're discussing, is whether those that have been hanging around for so long, in fact, we should just get rid of them and work on it next time.
Next time would be real soon, right? They have to do this every so many years.
Well,
for some of these folks, it's got to seem like they just barely finished and they got to start up again. And you can understand why local citizens just throw up their hands at land use planning, because it seems to be in a constant state of flux to them, because there's continual work and proposals to make changes. And I think the original idea was that we did it and we moved on to working with the plan, and only periodically came back, and periodically seems to be a pretty regular thing. So it frustrates me that in some communities it seems as though they're always trying to work out their plan because they never are able to get there. And I don't have a feel for why they don't get there. Is it lack of money or lack of commitment or too many things changing in their community or too much local opposition? I don't know.
Do you like me to...
Well, I just want you to tell me that it's going to get better. You're not saying that.
Chairman Ezerly, Senator Dukes, it's going to get better.
Thank you. I'll hold you to that.
Yeah, I think, Senator, when we get the report tomorrow, that gives a little better indication of really how big a problem it is.
Thank you. And I believe my final slide is on plan amendments. And these are for those amendments to the local comprehensive plans that are done outside periodic review. They're initiated by the local government or a property owner. And as we've already sort of discussed, our role is review. And actually, we've already talked about this to some degree. I did want to mention that this is a statutory process. And it can be similar to periodic review in terms of the types of plan amendments or plan updates that a city might undertake under this process. But they would be doing it under a different process, without a work program, without the timelines that are imposed by periodic review, and without DLCD's approval authority at the end. Typical examples of plan amendments include map changes. If somebody wants to change their property, for example, from residential to commercial, or from exclusive farm use to industrial, it would require an amendment to the local comprehensive plan map. Those typically are initiated by the property owner, and they go through the local jurisdiction, and notice is required to be sent to DLCD, and we would be involved in the advisory capacity. Only or largely. Other examples would include a code update without a plan amendment. Another example, right now there's a county that's updating its plan, a fairly significant project that they're doing what we call the Goal 8 mapping. I don't know if you've heard about this one yet. It's for destination resort siting, and they're doing that through the post-acknowledgement plan amendment process. My intention of these examples here is to show that there's a wide range of different types of plan amendments, ranging from some quite small to some quite large. and all locally generated. So that was all I had, unless there are any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Chair Mosley, I'm going to ask Lainey Smith to come up and talk about this next sort of set of tools. It's a set of tools that's not in the same kind of box, perhaps, as periodic review and plan amendment, but it relates to, I think, a point that Senator Dukes made yesterday about trying to improve in everything we do the sort of collaboration and moving it towards streamlining the process. So we want to spend a few minutes talking about some of the particular kinds of places where we're trying to collaborate better and streamline some processes. Lainey.
Good afternoon, Chair Messerly, members of the committee. I'm Lainey Smith, Operations Division Manager for DLCD. As Nan just said, this is a process or a tool that really is incorporated in part of all of our other tools. So to call it out separately is a little bit awkward, but it is an area that we're paying special attention to in terms of all of the other tools and the processes we have within the department. And specifically, there are areas that we're looking at that can bear fruit or we feel can bear fruit for us. One of those is the state agency integration. We're more and more, as we are doing the work that we do with local jurisdictions, working with other state agencies at the local level, with their field people talking to their field people and working directly with the communities, all working collaboratively to do problem solving, work with the local communities to deal with issues that they have. That's one area that we're working in. Rob Halliburton just talked quite a bit about periodic review, so I don't think I need to go into that in any particular detail. Urban growth boundary amendments, this is a process, and I think I might have even mentioned this yesterday, where we have a confusing process, not necessarily complex, but it's confusing because the requirements for amending a UGB are scattered in different places. Some are in the statute, some are in our rules, some are in our Goal 14 urbanization, and then there's a whole bunch of case law out there. So for someone to say, to just be able to open up a document and say, oh, here are the requirements that I have to meet in order to amend a UGB, it's not possible at this point. A couple of years ago, we did start a process to remedy that, to put all of those requirements in one place through doing some rulemaking. And that was suspended at the time that Measure 7 was adopted because there was just too much for the department to deal with, and because Measure 7 created some confusion about what we should and shouldn't be doing. At this point, what we're hoping to do or what we're planning to do come the new biennium is pick up that endeavor, that effort, and finish it, and hopefully streamline that process, make it more understandable for the people that are working with it. The grants and technical assistance also Rob Halliburton just mentioned too, and so I don't want to go into a lot of detail about that. I think one foundation thing here that I want to emphasize though is that we as a department are looking at doing business differently. And we're just beginning the effort toward an overall cultural change within the department to look at how we do business, how we work with local governments, to be more collaborative, to work at problem solving, and that getting to yes kind of attitude, I guess you could say. So that's sort of an effort that we think is worth highlighting here. And with that, I'll leave it to questions.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you. And the next sort of set of tools, which are starting to look now pretty much like programs, we'll have Ann Beyer talking about natural hazards planning and the Transportation Growth Management Program.
Good afternoon, Chair Meserly and members of the committee. My name is Ann Beyer. I'm the new Planning Services Division Director for the department, and it was fun to listen to the discussion of periodic review. I had worked in Umatilla County, one of the counties that's been in periodic review for a number of years, and part of the story on that is that things change at the local level. Umatilla County started periodic review in the early 90s when things were pretty calm there. By the late 90s, they had three big new employers, the Umatilla Army Depot, the Walmart Distribution Center, and a Union Pacific facility expansion. So their planning needs changed dramatically during the course of periodic review. People in the community recognize that because planning always involves the public. And so new work tasks get added. We approach work tasks differently from both the local and the state level. And what starts out to be a nice, concise little five-year process expands. And I don't know every community's story, but there's a lot of those stories throughout Oregon as communities try to use their planning programs to accommodate a variety of needs. It's a very complex program, and I think we all have to step back and recognize that there are both local and state factors that play on that. In the Planning Services Division, we have a number of programs. As Nan mentioned, we have the statewide experts. We have a farm forest specialist. We have the natural hazards specialist. We have a mineral and aggregate specialist. We have a rural and urban specialist, and we have the Transportation Growth Management Program. All of those folks serve a statewide audience, whether it's local citizens, whether it's local governments, whether it's supporting our field staff at getting to detailed programmatic issues. I think as we go through the next couple of years, you'll see the people who are called specialists out in the field more, subject to budget limits, but more working directly with communities where there's a need for that hands-on service. I think we can much better understand local issues that way.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
I have had an issue with these specialists in real applications in my district, and the question always was, are they there to actually help local government work through problems, or were they there to explain the DLCD way? And if you didn't understand the DLCD way, you were in deep trouble. And maybe you can help me understand with this cultural change in the agency how it is that you're going to make these technical people really neutral technical specialists and not advocates for particular outcomes, much less proselytizers for the DLCD way.
Senator Meserly, Representative Johnson, I can't speak for how I can make people do anything. I wish, you know, but I'll tell you what my approach has been. And I had been the natural hazards specialist for the department before taking this position. Usually I would get questions either from local governments or from citizens. If I got an issue raised from a citizen, I would call the local government to find out what their approach was. Then I would offer to go and sit down with, whether it was a citizen, a local government, whoever, to find out what the real issues are. With the Natural Hazards Program, I operated under an umbrella of a federal requirement, the National Flood Insurance Program. So I had a set of regulations that I had to work within, much like all our field reps work within the state statutes for land use and our administrative rules. So we have a law that we have to operate within. Sometimes sitting down with people, you can find out where the law applies, where the law doesn't apply, where there's room for flexibility. So I think what you'll see is a more hands-on approach to here's the law, here's how we can operate within that law. That's my philosophy. It won't always be easy to get beyond that. We do have state law that we have to uphold as specialists, and our administrative rules that our commission has adopted.
And if I may, Chair Mesley, Representative Johnson, I think part of the question you asked is it goes to management approaches and strategy. I mentioned yesterday that we're just in the process of developing some performance expectations for our staff that will be directives from myself and the management team to staff. I've had a number of conversations with some of the LCDC commissioners about things that they would like to see, in fact, included in performance expectations and work plans for agency staff. So what I'm telling you is we're trying to pay attention to that, and we've just started.
Mm-hmm. Now, I follow up, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that, and what I hope I'm trying to convey is the perception, if not the reality, that sometimes local folks, whether it was local government or it was local advocates on one side of an issue or another, felt muscled in a way that transcended, at least to the degree that I was involved, transcended technical assistance and became political outcome. And that was sometimes not welcome on the local level where issues were being worked through. So I'm appreciative that there's going to be some guidance that technical assistance means technical assistance. It doesn't mean coming in with a predisposed outcome, outside of the caveats that you gave about following the law, and I'm sympathetic to that.
Yeah, that's one of our requirements as public servants. So let me use some of...
We have another question.
Oh, excuse me.
I think maybe more of a... I think, Mr. Chair, you can recall Mike Greenfield came in and talked in your office with you and I sometime in June, and he was talking about the fact that the employees become protectors of the statute and the administrative rule. That's their emphasis rather than service. And that has to do with training and the mindset and having some sideboards or latitude that they can make decisions, not just boom, because that's what the law says. And that, mm-hmm. if the statutes aren't written right, maybe they don't have that latitude sometimes, and we need to understand that what we need to do there. But I think I find that everywhere, and I mentioned to Nan and Stephanie Halleck was another one that we've worked with, is that people would be the problem solvers and solution finders, and what oftentimes it's just a lot easier, hey, this is what the law says, this is what we have to do, but they don't expedite you through a system to get you to the end any quicker.
That's not a question. The question that comes to my mind when I see these experts that you're talking about in the different fields, Dogami, Department of Ag, Department of Forestry, the budget times we're in right now, does it make any sense at all to have an agreement with those departments to utilize staff out of those departments?
Chair Mesley, committee members, we do a lot of that informally because we don't have the we don't have the luxury of having expertise in all different fields. In natural hazards, our agency has received funding from the Federal Emergency Management Agency for a floodplain specialist, and that pays for 75% of our natural hazards program. We share our expertise with Department of Geology, with Oregon Emergency Management. We rely on them for their expertise on geologic hazards like landslides, earthquakes, tsunamis, those kinds of things, so that we can share our expertise. Department of Geology doesn't operate much in the land use planning field, where we need to implement some regulations to deal with hazardous areas such as floodplains. So we provide that expertise. They provide us with the technical information. Department of Forestry has provided us with technical information on landslide hazards. So we do integrate our efforts, and we've worked with those agencies through the Governor's Interagency Hazard Mitigation Team.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Well, I think that was a very responsive answer. I want to take it one step further into a level of detail, perhaps a little bit more. I noticed from my first session, last session, a proliferation of aggregate specialists across a whole bunch of agencies. ODOT's got one. You've got one. There are people working on aggregate, Dogami, works on that. And I've been curious why, other than that's a very complex issue fraught with lots of politics, but why there can't be a consolidation of some aggregate expertise in one place and we not have a proliferation of aggregate departments in all these different jurisdictions or agencies.
Chair Mesley and Representative Johnson, I think part of the dilemma that we need to sort through there, and I think the issue that you raise is one that we'll see in this budget discussion a little later. In the aggregates case, yes, there is the DOGAMI. ODOT also has its aggregate specialists, and you're asking a question, so why does DLCD need one? And I think our belief on that issue as well, and you can ask the same question for the farm and forest specialist. Why can't that person be an ag, or actually it's one person who is the farm and forest specialist. I think usually the distinction comes to how you look at problem solving and the land use system. The Department of Ag, DOGAMI, their sort of driving forces are quite different than sort of the land use driving forces. At some point, someone has to be able to take the technical information that might come out, for example, from a DOGAMI report and translate that into a way that can help either a local jurisdiction or, in the case of ODOT, another state agency, to apply that in our statewide land use planning system. You could argue, I think, that such a position ought to be in the substantive agency or in DLCD. The choice that we've made in the past is because there's that specialty need to link to the state land use system, that to have someone who is an expert in land use system who has sort of this side substance specialty is an efficient way of doing business. And I'm sure we'll talk about the aggregate position later.
In detail.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, I think Representative Krieger hit on a word that I think is maybe key to this whole thing, and that is authority to be flexible. And as I'm listening to all this, I'm thinking back through the different departments that we deal with. Forestry comes to mind. Regulate, very strict regulations, but they do have, the field people do have the authority to work through a problem. And as I think through DEQ, you know, a lot of the other departments, Department of Ag with some of their CAFO programs and things, where they work best is when there is authority, and I'm not saying to break the law or to, you know, to stretch it clear out of bounds, but just to make it fit on the ground, I think is really key to making the whole process work better. I know that I'm not blaming you folks for that. I think a lot of that is in the way we have written the laws, quite frankly. And it's something that I would be very open to any recommendations coming from your and other departments about. And I guess maybe a case to point, and this might be totally off the left field, but as I read your slide here, identify hazard areas, that's something I can understand. But then when it goes on, rather than to protect, it says and protect people and property from floods. How do you do that?
That's a specific question, Chair Mazzarelli and committee. But part of it is giving them the information to make good decisions, and that's a lot of what land use planning is about. So with floodplains, for example, we have flood insurance rate maps that give some assessment of where the flood hazard is. In those areas, we say not that you can't build there, but if you build there, you need to build so that you can protect yourself using our state building code that requires you to be elevated.
Okay, so that should read and to advise. Protect.
With the federal flood insurance program, there are certain minimum requirements that go into to protect. For other hazards, we don't have those minimal requirements, and we leave it to the community to go through a public process to assess what that risk means to their community and decide how to protect, what that means in the
the context of the community. And that's language within our own statewide planning goal that allows the community to do that risk assessment. With the flood insurance program is a condition of participating in the flood insurance program. Communities have to meet minimum standards, and we can't negotiate around those. So there is a minimum there for flood hazards. Did that answer your question?
I think so. I'd like you to finish.
Maybe we can move on here.
So we can get through these.
I just want to give you a couple of examples on natural hazards where we've worked directly with the community. The city of Bandon, Old Town Bandon, is really concerned about what they do as they're redeveloping. Downtown Bandon, the historic district, is in a floodplain, and there are certain federal requirements that apply as you do major improvements. So we're working with the city to come up with a plan on how to deal with improving their downtown area in a way that meets the community's needs and the federal requirements. We've been working in the last couple of months with a proposed development in Scappoose. A property owner or someone interested in purchasing property has a floodplain on the property and is trying to figure out how they can still go ahead with their development desires with that floodplain designation. I think we've been able to resolve that one by getting the Federal Emergency Management Agency involved, the Small Business Administration, and it's a case where we've been able to work with the locals to get the attention of the federal government to say, listen, this is an important thing to develop.
Are you finding that in some cases the accuracy of those flood maps are just way off base?
Yes, and we've worked with local governments and individuals to get those map problems resolved. In some cases, they underestimate the flood problem. In some cases, they overestimate the issue.
How's that coming? I know of some cases in my constituents where the requirement that they have flood insurance
mm-hmm.
when it's on a hillside.
Right.
And so it's quite expensive for them to begin with, but the process that they have to go through to change that designation is, I mean, the best shot is to pay off my property so I don't have to deal with it, because they could not, what I've been told is they just simply could not get the map changed.
Chair Messerly, in those situations, that's what the specialist can help, is to cut through that red tape, because there is a federal process, and it shouldn't be that burdensome, and if it is that burdensome, that's what the specialist is designed to help with.
And Chair Messerly, one more item to that. You'll note in our budget packages, we did have a package called Map Modernization that we expected to receive something over $2 million from the federal government to do that. Unfortunately, we will be withdrawing that package because the federal money is not available. FEMA has been reorganizing to be part of the Department of Homeland Defense, and the federal money has been reprioritized. But to let you know that we do recognize the issue and had hope to move a little bit in solving that, but won't be able to this biennium.
Isn't it true, though, it's not a state map, it's a federal map that they have to deal with?
Right, yeah, exactly.
So how does funding your department help that?
It was a map modernization project that mm-hmm. FEMA was funding.
Right,
okay.
No
and
state
so
funds.
It wasn't a state, fortunately, a state-funded issue, but unfortunately, we won't have the funds available to do the work.
I want to switch gears just a little bit and start talking about our Transportation Growth Management Program, which is another program within the Planning Services Division. And you're probably familiar with this. We have projects across the state. This is another program where we are really jointly operating this with the Department of Transportation. It's been a very efficient way to get at those issues where we're doing land use development and accounting for transportation issues. It's an area where we've been able to leverage federal dollars. It's been a very important program for both of the departments. We've been able to provide technical assistance to local governments across the state, very small ones and very large ones. We have several different programs within the Transportation Growth Management Program, a code assistant program, so a jurisdiction that has never adopted subdivision regulations has a program to help them with that. We have a quick response program that allows people or consultants to go in on a short notice to help facilitate development and address transportation and other livability issues. we have an outreach component to the Transportation Growth Management Program, and then grants to local governments to do transportation systems plans. And as we get into the arena of economic development, transportation infrastructure is so critical. So having this planning tool available is really helpful.
How many FTE are involved here?
Oh, dear. We have that in one of our charts. This is how new I am. I don't know how many staff I have. In that program, I think we have
nine.
We have grants managers. We have a number of planners, probably five or six planners who do that. We have an outreach position. That's within our department. There are other staff within the Department of Transportation.
And Chair Meserly, as we enter the 03-05 biennium, we're doing a couple of things with the staffing there. We're consolidating the grant administration over in ODOT and moving three FTE, four positions from our agency to ODOT to make that work better over there. That leaves us with five positions in that program as we enter 03-05.
So it was eight total?
I believe it was nine, if I counted, counted right.
So we went?
And it's eight FTE.
Okay, that's what I meant.
We have a there's a job share.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How much of the activities in the TGM are guided by statute? Let me ask my question a different way. When I hear from constituents about difficulties that they have had with either ODOT or DLCD, often it focuses in this area. And it focuses on the specifics of trying to get a curb cut for a business or even reestablish a cut that had a curb that had been an access point in the past and ceased to be used, and now they want to reestablish it. And almost universally, the answer seems to be of late, no. Even in rural communities where the curb cut is all that stands between bringing in a new business and not, if it's a business dependent on access. Intellectually, I understand why ODOT objects to a proliferation of curb cuts, but in a little distressed community like Clatskanie, and I don't know how familiar you are with Clatskanie. Senator Dukes and I share this little community. Again, I'm going back to the chair's flexibility point. Give me the authority that guides both ODOT and the TGM program there and in your shop, the authority that allows the answer to be no. Perhaps that's too 60,000 feet, because each one of these is going to be different with its own fact scenario. But build the framework for me to understand a little bit better the approach that you take to access on the highways and the relationship that that specific question has with the administration of this program. Too complicated?
No. But you may not like my answer, Chair Meserly, Representative Johnson. It's my understanding from all 2 weeks on the job that the statutory administrative framework for access management lies with the Department of Transportation. So our role in those discussions on curb cuts and access is fairly limited, because they have their authorities that they have to abide by. Now, I don't know the level of flexibility that they have, and you'd have to talk to somebody from the Department of Transportation in that regard, but we don't have standards or specifications or authority to deal with the access management component of transportation.
How collaboratively, then, as you begin period of the new culture development, how collaboratively will you and ODOT comb through those statutes to see where perhaps the one-size-fits-all response could be modified? What's good in urban Portland is not good in poor old Clatskanie. And I'm trying to get some assurance from you that in looking at streamlining, in looking at shortening the distance between a good idea and yes, that you guys might spend some time together looking at the statutes that govern those sorts of activities.
Chair Meserly, Representative Johnson, that sounds like a direction to us as opposed to a question, and it sounds like something we need to explore, and we're certainly willing to explore it. Because we've heard that it, you know, from other communities that there may be issues with access management decisions. And again, we may not have the authority, but we can provide a forum for those discussions.
Senator Dukes, and then Representative Craig.
Is all of the money from your five positions that will be remaining, does all of that come from ODOT?
Chair Meserly, Senator Dukes, the money comes through ODOT from the federal government. There is a general fund match to that.
Yeah, Chair Meserly, Senator Dukes, the funding for the positions is sort of defined in our relationship with ODOT. About 75 or perhaps 78% mm-hmm. of it comes as federal highway funds to ODOT and then comes to us as other funds. The remainder of that is general mm-hmm. fund, which speaks to the reason for why some of these positions are in DLCD, and that is there are certain activities in this program that cannot be funded with highway dollars. A lot of the land use planning related activities. So that's why there is a general fund general fund contribution to those positions. So that the positions that we have are split funded, and the positions that ODOT has, I believe, are entirely either federal funds or transportation funds.
That sounds like you've figured it out a little bit better than ODOT has. I give you my little mini speech that I give to ODOT every 2 years, and that's that TGM grants had become sort of like candy. We just kind of handed them out when a local government needed it, especially the quick response ones. I don't know that you can sit down in a community conversation that needs, you know, what if we did this, what if we did that, or let's do this, and somebody doesn't say, there's a, you know, we can get a quick response grant. And my caveat is, those that are funded with transportation dollars need to link up with transportation mm-hmm. In some reasonable way. I have seen money given away for all kinds of interesting things. There were good projects, don't get mm-hmm. me wrong. They mm-hmm. really were. It's just that you had to be very creative to get a transportation. I mean, yes, there was a road mm-hmm. running out in front of the project is about what it came down to. Not that we were really going to impact that road, but there was one out there. And so I would just say that the money is there for a reason. And even though there are lots of demands on the money, let's not get too creative when we're talking dedicated funds. But you have the other funds that are available to do the more specific land use planning, which I'm sure is very helpful.
Senator Krieger.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes and I think we spent, 16 days on ODOT?
Is that all?
it was terrible.
Seemed like a long time.
At any rate, we had one day that was mostly had to deal with access, and there were many stories told, and, of course, Senator George had some dandies. Some of them have been on the board, 1947, they said, this one?
Oh, that's his bypass. Yeah.
And I think I see a willingness within ODOT to, under Bruce Warner, mm-hmm. to give some of this latitude we're talking about. And Senator Meserly is aware of the Misty Meadows, where there was no way that they could comply Vision 51 about access. But I drug him from Salem down there, and we got a lot of it taken care of. And there's been several instances that's taken place. So I can have a conversation, Representative Johnson, with you how to make some of those things happen.
We welcome you to Plattsburgh and I anytime.
It's not in the humps, is it?
No.
Those were the points that I needed to make on transportation growth management. Are there other questions?
I don't think so. I think we're pretty well wore up.
Well, Senator Meserly, I noticed you looking. We actually had hoped to do two more slides.
Go ahead.
Today.
We've got 10 minutes, so.
And that was to look at sort of the last sort of set of tools slash programs that we do. And I will try to speak very quickly about the coastal program, which, of course, is what I did until 7 weeks ago. The coastal program, as we indicated a little bit earlier, is a distinct program that is entirely federally funded. The funds come from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and their Office of Coastal Zone Management. It supports Oregon's federally approved Coastal Zone Management Program. The core pieces of that program are the four coastal goals. Some of the specific activities, and many of you who are coastal legislators, well, you all are coastal legislators, have certainly come in contact with some of the projects. We have a particular emphasis on some coastal hazard issues. We've done work on what's called littoral cell planning, of looking at the movement of sediment between headlands. We've worked with communities on things like setbacks and particular hazard areas. We've worked on the issue of hardening the bluffs or the dunes to protect upland development. There was a bill that moved out of committee just this morning on that issue. That's a Goal 18 issue. We've also worked with the help of a lot of NOAA funding on, we mentioned earlier, the Coastal Atlas as a fairly keen tool. And we also do some work in the ocean resources area. And Representative Krieger's bill passed out of committee this morning in the ocean resources area. So I think we will actually even be doing better work in that arena.
And let me ask, is the department supporting those bills?
We have worked very closely on both those bills and are in a position now where we can support them.
No more. Thank you.
The last tool I want to spend a minute on is a very unique tool that's part of the coastal program. This is called Federal Consistency. The Federal Coastal Zone Management Act has a provision that allows states that have federally approved coastal management programs, such as Oregon's, to exercise a level of actual control over federal projects that is not seen in any other act, to my knowledge. It allows the state not only to have a seat at the table when federal projects or federally permitted projects or federal activities on the Outer Continental Shelf, particularly in the oil and gas arena, when they're being discussed, the state has a seat at the table, and the state can review those projects and permits and activities for what's called consistency with the state's program. And for us, that means consistency with those four coastal goals, the regulations that implement those, and each of the local comprehensive plans. So this is a way that local jurisdictions can have involvement in the federal decision-making process. Most of the time, it's a process that is at the level of individual permit reviews. It goes fairly quickly. Most of the time, issues are worked out ahead of time. And we have enough history with it now that the federal agencies kind of know what to expect, know what questions to ask, and know what the plans are, that we can solve a lot of problems pretty quickly. There are some big issues out there where federal consistency will be a player, and one of those is in the districts of Senator Dukes and Representative Johnson, and that's the Columbia River Channel Deepening Project. It's the federal consistency tool that has allowed the state and the local jurisdictions to, and I will characterize it as, try to get a seat at the table and try to get attention of the federal decision makers that there is a role for the state and local governments in this. And both the senator and representative also know that that's a pretty hard job, but it is a tool that gives us a seat at the table.
And can I work the other way? We've got some issues, I think you know, one on the Umpqua River, and it's aggregate extraction, but we can't get the federal government to move. So does your department help push some of these issues too? I mean, we're holding up a major part of the economy in the mid-coast, south coast.
Chair Mazzoli, the laws and the regulations that govern federal consistency from a state's perspective, unfortunately, don't allow what Coastal Zone Junkies call positive federal consistency. We cannot force a federal agency to do something. We only can require that whatever they do be consistent with our state program.
But in many cases, the federal laws and rules have precedence over the state, right? I'm thinking of the Endangered Species Act, some of these other things.
Chairman, so that would be true.
Right.
Well, actually, with that's sort of the end of what we had planned to present to you today, and we can answer questions.
Any questions, or do we want to quit early?
And our thought, Chair Mazzoli, members of the committee, would be tomorrow then to go into the sort of budget stuff.
Okay. Good enough. Thank you very much. With that, if there's no more questions, I will close the public hearing. And are there any announcements for the committee?
Yeah.
Jeremy?